Don. Good evening. It is indeed a genuine pleasure and a special honor for me to introduce Dr. Alan Ballard to you this evening. Dr. Ballard earned the bachelor's degree, Phi Beta Kappa, from Kenyon College, and the master's degree and the Doctor of Philosophy degree from Harvard University, the oldest institution of higher learning in America, founded in 1636, and one of the best universities in the world. He served as the University Dean of Faculty at the City University of New York, and as University Dean for Academic Development at the City University of New York. He's also served as chair of the Department of Africana Studies here at the University at Albany, a department that he helped to turn around. He did the groundwork for our master's program being ranked number one in America, and for our bachelor's program being ranked number 10 in the country. His administrative skills, pure scholarship, and prolific publications have been a tremendous credit to the University at Albany, where he is loved by students and colleagues, and where he sets an example for all of us. He has published in the New York Times, in the Philadelphia Tribune, and in Change Magazine, to name just a few sources among the many in which he has published scholarly articles. He has been the recipient of a Harvard Fellowship, a Ford Foundation grant, a Fulbright grant, and a John A. Whitney grant, among many others. He served as a member of the Board of Overseers at Harvard and was the recipient of the Distinguished Service to Black Education Award given by the Yale University Black Alumni Association. He has published a number of books, among them Where I'm Bound, The Education of Black Folk, One More Day's Journey, and most recently, Carried by Six. Dr. Ballard's characters in his novels have seen, in the words of Charles Dickens, the best of times and the worst of times. Some of them think more deeply and obstinately than others. Their world is complex because of their circumstances and history and oppression. Some characters master their emotions. Others strive for salvation through the grace and teachings of family or friends or divine providence. By reading his lean prose with its economy of diction and strong character development and powerful dialogue, we leave his masterpieces believing that despite it all, the human spirit will triumph. His heroes and heroines are laconic and cynical and not given to gushing, and yet we perceive that under their hardness, they have the same impulses and emotions as the rest of humankind. As readers of his powerful works, we enlarge our literary understanding by looking into this great author's world and even taking a peek into his soul. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Alan Ballard, our next Ralph Ellison of the 21st century.
Good evening, everybody.
I want to first of all thank Dr. Slade for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank the Writers Institute. Specifically, I want to thank Bill Kennedy here for having instituted this so many years ago and for making it such a welcome place for writers of all sorts over so much time. He's done a great job, and I think we should just give him a hand.
Acknowledge the presence of Don Falk.
I'm going to do that.
All right. Because it wouldn't be what it is without
him. I was going to move on to Don. I wasn't going to forget it. And then there is Don Faulkner here, of course, who's been a director of the Institute. And we have Suzanne Lance here, who's been the right arm to Don. So I think I've thanked everybody. What I'd like to do this evening is, to read a bit and maybe sing a bit, depending on my mood, frankly, right? Because it gets to be kind of complicated when you do both of them at the same time. So I'm probably going to read and then maybe play a couple of songs on the guitar at the end, right? So we'll do it that way. It works out. The book is carried by six. I'll just start reading from the first part, set in Philadelphia, my hometown. And I'll start reading from the very first chapter, okay? Obie Bullock pulled his battered old Chevy sedan in front of the Joseph E. Hill projects, checked the sign, and double parked. Got out of the car and mopped the sweat from his brow with a big red handkerchief. It was only 8 o'clock in the morning. The pavements in North Philly were already warming up, just like every other day this week. He began a short walk to his building, past graffiti concrete tables. The old men were already out playing cards. One looked up. Just getting into the job. You know it. Any of you see Dora Lee this morning? Heading towards the bus about 15 minutes ago, another player said. Looking good too, man. Go figure. Prettiest girl, woman in this place, and she's married to somebody ugly as you. Obie laughed and aimed an air punch at him. The old man stood and threw up his arms. Come on if you dare. These the fists that destroyed Bucky Jackson. Man, I know I can't stand against the mighty Tyrone Waters. With that, Obie took off a run towards the building entrance. The entire table collapsed in laughter, the other men clapping their hands and encouraging Tyrone, a bent over senior citizen. Go get him. You know Obie ain't nothing for you. Show him, Tyrone. Do your bad thing on him. Tyrone stood and shouted after his disappearing foe, Obie. Don't mess with me, man. Thunderbolts in these here fists. Still laughing, something he hadn't done a lot of lately, Obie entered the lobby. He looked up and down the corridor for Roy, who was away from his desk. Damn! The House Committee had met with the police just 3 nights ago and agreed that 2 officers would be assigned to the building and that one would always be on duty at the front desk, no matter what. You'd think that the rape and murder of little Shakisha a month ago would be enough to make them keep their promise. And it wasn't like Roy to leave that desk unattended. When he had to take a break, he'd go ask one of the men outside to take over for a few minutes. Obie sighed. This was no way to help make this place safe for the kids and the old folks, much less stop Son Tickle's gang from taking over the building. He walked to the desk. A copy of Ebony lay half open on it, like Roy had been interrupted while he was reading. He pulled out the chair and he sat down, ready to stay there until he came back. Probably he'd just gone into the recreation room to take a leak. Obie's sitting there now. Morning to you, Miss Taylor. That dress fits you just right. Ought to knock them out in the office today. Obie smiled up at a tall, graceful woman whose body was snugly wrapped in a yellow dress speckled with Yoruba symbols. Yes, ma'am, you will surely be the queen of Chestnut Street this beautiful day. The Lord has sent. She grinned, blew him a kiss on the way out the door. Ought to be ashamed of yourself, Orbit, where you'd be sweet talking to people all the time. He had a snappy comeback ready, but just then four kids, followed by their 26-year-old mother, burst out of the elevator and were all over him before he could even say hello. Where's the candy? When you gonna ride me piggyback again? You promised me first, didn't you, Orbit? Their mother, Serena, quickly reined them in. Orbit, you spoil them rotten. One day I'm gonna leave them with you for good. Orbit laughed. I wouldn't mind one bit. He looked at the kids. We'd have us a ball, wouldn't we? Then they nodded unanimously, thinking perhaps the homemade oatmeal, raisin cookies, and fruit punch that always awaited them when they stopped in at the Bullock's apartment. Then they were off, propelled through the door by Serena. Orbit turned back to Ebony, where Roy had apparently been reading an article about the 50 leading eligible bachelors of the year. Maybe his good buddy, stationed in the Hill Project for the past 4 years, had been hoping he'd make the list someday. Orbit didn't get a chance to look at much of the article, what with the elevator banks constantly disgorging people. All of them had something to say to Orbit, who by this point was hurting for sleep. Around 8:30, the elevator traffic slowed down. The building had just about emptied itself out, leaving only the old, the unemployed, and three or four of Sun Tegel's gang members embedded in the apartments of decent folk. They had come back from prison, most of them, settled in with their mothers or grandmothers, and proceeded to sell drugs. That's what the meeting the other night had been all about. Now, Roy still hadn't come back, and Obi was worried. Given all the problems with security lately, he hadn't wanted to leave the desk unoccupied and go off looking for Roy. But freed now of this distraction caused by the comings and goings of the residents, he took a careful look at the rec room door and saw that it was slightly ajar. And wait a minute, Roy's key ring was still in the lock. Yet the room was dark. Something wrong here. He quietly pushed the door open and turned the light switch on with his left hand. As he walked, he reached for the gravity knife he always carried in his pants pocket. Might be illegal, but it sure made him feel better. He pulled the knife from his pocket and with a quick flick of his wrist snapped the blade into its locked position. You in there, Roy? Silence. Roy, I say you in there, man? He moved down the wall of the room at a half crouch, easing towards the still darkened alcove where the restrooms were. When he reached them, he burst into the men's room, knife forward. He looked into the corner of the bathroom. Roy's inert body lay sprawled between the corner and an overturned trash can. Blood was still coming from a wound in his throat and spreading over his white shirt with his silver badge. It was all over his blue pants and forming a pool on the floor. On his shirt lay an envelope addressed to the Men of Africa United, which was Obi's organization. Obi picked it up and was about to open it when he heard what sounded like a stall door opening. The killer was still there. Obi reached down, pulled the Glock 9mm weapon from Roy's holster, and slowly opened the men's room door and walked out. Yes, the first. That's the introduction. Now, Obi ends up with a situation where he basically has to kill somebody who is a member of the gang and very close to some people in the projects. And Obi starts walking into the projects after all this killing thing is done. And some kids and a gang are standing over there. And Obi's walking with his family. And Obi, his wife is Dora Lee. Those kids were friends of Trevon, who was the person he killed, and junior affiliates of the Tico gang. Obi knew them all by name. Wasn't one of them he hadn't tried to set right. But the dealers had too many things to offer them, and he'd lost the contest for what was in fact those kids' lives. 5 years from now, they'd all be dead, crippled by gunshot wounds or stuck away in some prison cell. One cop turned back to Obie, being escorted by some cops, and said, "Want me to shut him up?" Obie was holding Dora Lee, his wife, by her hand while the kids walked in front of them and said, "Leave him be." As the bullets approached the entrance to the apartment building, the boy started to shout, "Gonna get you, Timber, that's Obie's son. Better watch out, faggot." Timber had a fade haircut and a confident talk, with walk with just a hint of the street in his stride. He suddenly darted across the playground. Before anybody could stop him, he crashed into the leader of the gang and smashed up the broom box. He was about to throw it on the sidewalk when one of the cops came up from behind and grabbed the box and held Timber back. The other cop gave the broom box to its owner and scattered the kids. They retreated to a far corner of the yard where they regrouped. Their leader turned off the machine even louder and shouted, "You, Tomba, you faggot, your ass is mine," as his bullet family and a police escort finally entered the apartment building. Just as everybody was on the elevator and the door was about to close, Obie stepped out, nodded to the cops, and said, "See the family upstairs, I'll be right up. I got something to do." He walked slowly out of the building door and towards the gang of boys. Now the group at the table came to light. The old man at the table. "Obie, man, what you doing? You crazy or something? Don't be no fool now, Obie." He kept on walking across the yard. When he got within 10 feet of the teenagers, he said, "The one, Desha, the Mumba, the rest of you, come on over here for a minute." His voice was low but clear. Every word seemed to echo through the yard. "I want to tell you something, and turn that thing down." Looks of astonishment and disbelief came over their faces. But at one time, when they were all younger, Obie had been one of the few caring men in their lives. Some vestige of gratitude remained. Dewan, their leader, nodded to the fellow with the boom box, and he turned it off. "Mr. Bullock, ain't nothing you can tell us. You off Trevon, and he was our brother. End of the story." Obie's eyes ranged across the angry faces of the boys, all of whom wore their hair in Rastafarian style and their balloon-style pants low on their hips, tattoos adorned their arms. "Trevon is dead and gone, and I'm truly sorry I had to kill him. Ain't nothing to be proud of, but he cut Roy's throat. Then he tried to machine gun me. So I killed him stone dead. And that's an awful waste of a human life. Because Trevon could have been a lawyer, or a doctor, or a major league star, not just some janitor like me. The sky was the limit for him, and he never got off the ground. But that ain't neither here nor there right now. Question is about you all." Dewan looked at Obie like he was a fool. "Us?" "Yes, you." Obie aimed his finger dead in the center of Dewan's chest. "Because you're going to end up the same way as Trevon if you don't change your ways. Find you all a job, a school, something to do, because cops and no cops, your bosses upstairs are no." He jerked his head up towards the apartments that had been taken over by the dealers. "I will personally hold each and every one of you responsible for anything that happens to anybody in my family, or for that matter, any of the decent folks that live in this here project." The boys were silent, and Dewan, along with the rest of them, almost unconsciously took a step backward from Obie. They all knew what he had done to a 6-foot, 250-pound lunatic who had come swinging a knife in the middle of the playground one day, threatening to kill the screaming toddlers, walked straight up to the man, grabbed him, and drew the lock, turned him around, and busted his knife arm before he could slash even one of those children. Obie folded his arms across his chest. "Now you all gone home, and you mourn Trevon. That's the right and proper thing to do. Mrs. Tickle can use a lot of sympathy right now, and I feel sorry for her. But don't come messing with me and my family, because you'll find a heap of trouble." Out of the corner of his eye, Obie saw one boy who seemed to be trying to conceal himself behind the others. He was light brown skinned, wore his hair bald, and was dressed in a summer shirt and regular cut blue slacks. "You Hashim. Don't you be trying to hide from me. Especially you don't want to see your ass nowhere around here. Now all of you get He turned and walked off. And as he reached the door and looked back, they were gone. The men at the table were mute. Obie had walked into the line, standing out again. A couple of them kids would soon shoot a man as take a drink of water. Obie and his family began getting very much, and Darlene began getting very much upset by this whole thing that's going on. Because his daughter gets kidnapped, and Obie has to deal with that, which he does in his inevitable way, as you can imagine by now. And then they finally have a day when they go down to the beach together, Obie and Dorothy. Their daughter had gone off Sabaya. Dorothy was dressed in a blue blouse and white slacks. And she said, "We still have time left. It's only an hour and a half down to Wildwood. Let's drive down and walk the beaches for a while. Then we can have dinner and go back. We can have something from this weekend, honey." True, there were a lot of things for her to do. Study for the exams on Tuesday night, shop for next week's church dinner, take care of work left over from the office. But she and Obie needed some downtime. Day of fun. She took his hand. "Honey, turn on the radio and see if we can get our gospel station." In seconds, the stirring yet soothing music she loved so much filled the car. A deep male voice sang, "I cried and I cried, I cried all night long. You know I cried and I cried until I found the Lord." Traffic thinned, and Obie began to drive down towards Wildwood. As his music played, he started up his rhythmic pounding of the steering wheel and began to sing along with the radio. "My soul just couldn't rest contented." And Lord Dorothy joined in with him. "Lord knows it just couldn't be contented." The blending of those voices with the singers on the radio turned the interior of their broken down Chevy with its torn seat cushions and its odometer long stopped at 125,872 miles into a temple of joy. Dorothy looked at Obie in his loud green shirt unbuttoned at the collar, his face shining, lost in the music, looked at her man and thanked God for him. Another hymn started up. Obie smiled, humming the melody. And Dorothy just squeezed his hand tighter. Twice she did it, then chanted softly the words to him. "Yes, there's a cross for everyone, and there's a cross for me." They pulled into the municipal parking lot down at Wildwood, and soon were walking along on a long beach. They found a quiet spot, and Obie spread out a section of the Sunday newspaper on the sand for them to sit. Out of the other pages of the newspaper, he made two triangle-shaped hats to shade them from the sun. Dorothy still loved this place. It was here that Obie had first brought her when they were courting. She'd bring him home a picnic basket full of fried chicken and potato salad to sit and read the Sunday Inquirer, while Obie, barely stopping to eat, would be off and running with his fishing tackle towards the water. Sometimes Dorothy would sit and watch, enjoying the way he'd throw that long pole back, gave a long, quick flick of his wrist, and hurled the bait on its line far out towards the ocean, where it would hover for a moment in the air before it plunged into the foamy water. Now, over the ocean, seagulls were swooping down from the sky, snatching their prey from the water and flying off, pursued by other gulls, shrieking for their share of the poor fish. Seemed like someone or something always had to suffer in this world. Dorothy turned to Obie. "I'm so glad you brought me down here. Funny, but even with everything, all my troubles, they seem to flow away when we get down here." Obie was interrupted for a second by some teenagers. And then Dorothy turned to him. "Baby, what are we gonna do?" "What do you mean, Dorothy? We're gonna do what we've been doing. We're gonna make it safe where we live. But can't you see what's happening? I do nothing but worry all day long." She took her hand off of his arm. Last week I failed my exam in advanced algebra, she's in community college. I just didn't have any time or concentration to study. Orby moved closer and cradled her head against his chest. Baby, I know we've got a lot going on in our lives, and it ain't just the threats. There's all these pressures of college and the kids' clothes and things. And Jason was her son, being over there in Afghanistan and all. But one thing stays on my mind all the time, and that's poor little Shakisha. Dora Lee shuddered at the mention of the little girl's name. That child was on her way to being somebody and doing something in life. And Sun Tegel's boys, I don't care what they say about strangers doing it, was involved somewhere or other. And if they wasn't directly involved with it, they've messed things up around here enough, made decent folks scared enough, that they set it up for her to be raped and left there the way those bastards left her. Dora Lee remembered how he had come into the apartment the night of the killing, told her what had happened, then gone into the bedroom and pounded their mattress with his fist till she feared he'd break the whole bed down with the force of his blows. He'd only stop when his son Temper shouted, "Mama, Mama, you better call the cops. Daddy's going out of his mind." Opie now tilted her chin up and looked her straight in the eyes. "You can leave if you want to, Dorothy, but God has placed me here in these projects to protect and help these folks. And I ain't deserving, and I ain't deserting them for nothing or nobody. Much as I would lay down my life for you and Timber and Sabaya. I ain't going nowhere, baby, but you go if you feel you got to." He glanced down the beaches of away. "Shucks, might as well have asked Dr. King not to go to jail, or Malcolm not to make that speech at the Audubon. No, I ain't leaving." "There you go again, Obi, comparing yourself to dead heroes. They're gone now and we're running out of money. Sabaya's going to need something for college, and sending these kids by plane down to North Carolina has just about emptied the savings account. We only got $800 left on the one credit card that's not maxed out. Then what we going to do?" "Well, baby, I don't want to start nothing now, but you could stop buying fancy dresses." Dorothy got to her feet. "You know I need to look nice at work. No, let's stop it. I won't let us spoil our afternoon, honey. This is precious time." Opie shrugged his shoulders, picked up a little twig from the sand, broke it, then threw the two pieces of wood away. "Baby, I'm sorry I said that. I think we're going to be okay. Look, in 2 more weeks we'll be in Carolina on vacation, and we'll get a chance to get ourselves together. That seems a long way off. Nobody will know we're down there, and we'll be able to figure out what to do before the fall comes. In the meantime, I'll call my brother and tell him to get Sabaya a job down there. That'll take a load off of us a little. But I still feel nervous." "Don't worry, baby. God got us in the palm of his hands. Never failed us yet." Dorothy nodded, then put her head back on Opie's shoulder and began to cry quietly. Soon, with Opie's arms tight around her, she calmed herself. That's the way it was with them. Argue again, make up again. But one time soon, okay, so that's Opie. Opie organizes a march. He organizes a march, and they're going to march through central Philadelphia, and they're going to protest and things of this sort. The march is going on. Okay, down through Philadelphia. There's a reporter who's looking at them, right? "Today he saw 8 or so young black men standing on a corner. They weren't dealing, but their body language is definitely cocky. One thing was sure, they weren't going to give up their corner without a fight. A short, stout woman, part of one of the church's groups, broke away from the march line and called out to one of the young men, 'Hey, you Malik, you boy, what you doing out there?' Ain't it enough they done killed two of your brothers? All last night your mama was crying for you, been looking for you for 2 days. Come on, child, do right, come with us. The boy she was talking to, short and thin, with a clean-shaven head and stubble on his chin, couldn't have been more than 18. He looked from the woman to the group he was with, then back to the woman. Mrs. Watkins, you just leave me be. You tell mama I'm fine, I'll be home in a few days. The woman put her hand on her hips and shook her head. You're going to be home all right. In a great big black funeral car. Some of her fellow church members were pulling at her arms, and a marshal, distinguished by a red and green sash across his chest, came up to coax her away from the corner. She walked away, but not until she delivered her parting shot. I be praying for you children, Melly. You breaking your mama's heart. Gonna put that poor woman in her grave. By the time the marchers reached City Hall, 45 minutes later, Shapiro was astounded by the size of the crowd. By God, there was no room in the plaza. Everywhere he turned, there were people. He thought he'd be crushed to death if he tried to make it to the press area, but he had to give it a shot. So he said goodbye to his newly made friends from Mount Moriah Church and struck off through the crowd. It took a while, but he made it to the press area. Right? So he's looking at it. The leaders of the march gradually made their way up to the podium through the crowd. On stage, a gospel choir, the women dressed in white blouses and black skirts, the men in black pants and shirts, began to sway back and forth. Then, as their leader brought her hand down in a signal to begin, they started to sing. We will not be moved. We shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's planted by the water, we shall not be moved. The crowd began to take up the verses, and the singing spread out over the plaza, gathering volume and power as the thousands of blending voices created their own unique sound. The singers in the choir, black faces glistening from sweat, seemed to draw energy from the crowd. Their swaying motion became even more pronounced, their voices even louder, and then, led by a woman with her head tilted to the side, eyes fixed on high, the singers began clapping, soon joined by the throng in the plaza. Shapiro watched a little girl in a pink dress with white lace around her sleeves begin to clap too, her tiny hands keeping exact time in her mouth, voicing the words of the song as if she had been born singing it. She couldn't have been more than 3 years old. Now a tall, light, brown-skinned man, even bigger than Obi, came to the center of the stage, took the portable microphone out of its holder, and began to pace back and forth, starting the first lines of each stanza of the song. Shapiro recognized him as Brother Carter James, a famous gospel singer. Even if he hadn't recognized that face, he'd have known the voice. The song just poured out of him, his voice now dipping low, now soaring high, now smooth and melodious, now rough and guttural. It made Shapiro think of strong trees bent low by stormy winds with springing upward every time the gust relented, of cresting waves swirling and foaming and reaching high just before they crashed on a beach, of those moments when a lightning storm burst out on a summer's night, its flashing bolts so close together they illuminate the entire landscape. He found himself clapping and singing along with the crowd. He stopped and made a few notes on this thing. They welcomed preacher after preacher until finally they bring their speaker, Obie Bullock. Obie Bullock gets up there, he says, no need for me to go into a lot of detail about him. This is the introduction. This is a man who finished high school in a small town in North Carolina, served honorably in the U.S. Army, and came to Philly, where he met his beloved wife, Dorothy, one Sunday morning at a chicken dinner after church service, and began to raise his family. He's been in Philly ever since, except when he's called back into the service for Iraq and was wounded there. The good book says, by their deeds you shall know them, and it's by his deeds that we know Big Obie. Ladies and gentlemen, I present him to you. The crowd burst into applause. Obie pushed himself up from the chair, walked to the podium, shook hands with the talk show host. He His white shirt was soaked from the heat and humidity, and he carried a white handkerchief that even from this distance, Shapiro could see was already wet. On a large platform, Opie seemed almost small. He stood silent at the lectern for a moment. Then as the applause grew, he stepped to the side of the platform and began to clap, as if to thank the crowd for their support. He raised one hand, and as the applause died down and the crowd stilled, he began to speak. "First of all, I want to thank Almighty God for life and for bringing us here together this afternoon. Those of you who know me know I ain't much of a speaker, but I believe God's going to help me what I got to do to say what I got to say today. Don't take no fancy words to say why we're here. We want to get the drug dealers out of our community and take charge of our own lives. Children being wasted, hearse running out of churches, rolling out of churches every week with our boy children. 22 children killed last year, 19 of them black, and all but one of them a male. 406 homicides last year, and close to 80% of them black males. Mamas be weeping all the time. Looks like the only time we see ourselves serious is on television. Only time we be wearing suits and ties is when we mourning, when the gospel choir is singing and some preacher's asking, why, oh Lord, did you have to take such a young life? Our favorite scripture is Job and his tribulations. In the last month, I've been to 2 funerals of boys killed because of drugs. Oh, I don't guess I have to tell you what it's like, because you surely been there too, if you black and if you poor. And you stood in that pew facing the cross, heard the preacher come up the aisle chanting, thou art the resurrection and the life, holding the Bible in his hand and leading the family into the church. And you stood over them caskets to see our boy children all dressed up for church gone, but their faces can't move, hands can't clap, tongues can't sing God's praises. Only time a preacher gets to talk to most of our young people is when they come to the church to bury one of their friends. Oh, I don't know about you, but I ain't no ways tired. Gonna stay on this battlefield. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Ain't gonna let no giggle gang turn me around. Ain't gonna let no falsely accusing DA turn me around. And surely no devil gonna turn me around. My God rides shotgun for me. Yes, he does. Opie paused and shouts came from the crowd. Hallelujah! Say so, brother. Preach it. Preach it. Opie's face became even more serious and his voice more powerful and cadent. Now you all know I was under threat of indictment for defending my own family, me and my friend Leroy. Now don't God work in mysterious words? Ways? Didn't he deliver Daniel? Yes, the crowd shouted. Didn't he deliver the Hebrew children? Yes, he did. Didn't he deliver Leroy and Mary? Yes, he did. And didn't he deliver Opie Bullock? Yes, he did. Some women from the choir broke ranks and ran down to throw their arms around Opie. Others jumped and stomped up and down the stage, some going into holy dance, their bodies twisting and turning in rhythmic jerks across the wooden floor. Shapiro was afraid the motion of so many bodies might cause the platform to collapse. Across the street, a man with a rifle stood behind a blackboard poster on a roof looking at Opie. So. So I think that's enough reading. that's enough. So if you have questions, I'll take them now. That's what I'd like to do. Yeah.
What happens next?
There are books for sale back there. Right. Yeah.
How long did you spend writing the book?
Probably altogether around 8 years. I was telling Mr. Faulkner here that in its first version, it was 545 pages. And now it's not even, it just barely makes 300 pages. And all that was just kind of, you know, the things that I wanted to say and I wanted to get on paper and I didn't want to take them out, but I had an editor, she's a, you know, private editor, who was a great, great woman, and her name is Rennie Brown. She won't let a sentence go. She won't let any word go, anything go, and everything has to be cut, cut, cut. And sometimes when she's finished saying you gotta cut this, you gotta cut that, it feels like she's cutting your heart out. But that's the way, you know, that's what you have to do. So that's what it took. It went through many, many versions and many, many kinds of, you know, things, different introductions to the book, different scenes, deeper characterizations of the females, for example, because it was such a male kind of oriented thing that I had to go back and actually rewrite Dora Lee's part. Yeah, so it's a lot of work. Yeah. Young man over here.
What helped inspire you to write this book and many other books that you've written?
What inspired me to write it was the condition of young black people who are poor and who are basically in situations where sometimes in their lives they don't have a chance. And don't have a chance because of where they were born and the environment to which they were born. And my hope was that somehow or another I could say something about that. I guess what I've seen so much in youngsters, we see them, as Deacon Williams knows here, sometimes we see them in the church on Sunday, on Saturday morning in the soup kitchen. And you see youngsters coming in, sometimes led by a 12-year-old sister, and she's got like three other kids behind her. And yet, those children are so bright and so vital. Their eyes sparkle, you can see the intelligence in them. And I wonder all the time about what their fate is going to be and all the odds that are stacked against them. I think a lot of the way that I feel about the situation came from different situations in my own life. And what I mean by a different situation, my own life, when I was growing up in Philadelphia, I was in a, well, how you can put it, poor but not poor neighborhood. There are a lot of poor black children in my segregated school where I went to elementary school. And of, say, 25 of us who started in, say, the fifth or so in kindergarten, we lost 7 or 8 of them dead to TB. And the kids sometimes, this has stayed with me all my life, they would come to class and start coughing and you'd see blood. And the most important thing about it, or I guess not the important thing, those kids were much smarter than me. Like somehow or another, I managed to, you know, to end up at Kenyon and be Phi Beta Kappa and go to Harvard and all that. But most of those kids were smarter than I was. And never made it because of circumstances. And that has propelled me practically all of my life.
year is that Donald taking place?
It's contemporary. It's contemporary. Yeah.
Did you recognize at that point in elementary school that seeing these your fellow students die on TV was going to propel you to excel in your own life?
No, you never. I don't think when you're young, I don't think you ever understand what's happening to you. I mean, you basically are formed, and you're formed by a lot of things going on around you, but you don't know how those things are going to impact you, and you can't think about it. I just know that when I was writing my autobiography, that whenever I write over at that period, I just can't finish writing it. Sometimes it just breaks down. It's still deep in me, deep. Like I'm mourning, because you're never so tight as you are when you're like with these, these are kids like your blood. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, hey, Craig, yeah.
Mariah, Marilyn, and Carrie by Six, your main characters are, I think, heroic in a sort of traditional sense. You know, these are men that rise above the accomplishments of mere mortals like us. I'm wondering to what extent that it kind of helps you sort of move into that emotional territory a little bit. I mean, the strength of those characters help you to deal with some of that pain.
He's a writer. Number one, right? And also he's a great critic too. He's a great critic. He's sharp. And some of you students who have had him for a writing teacher know what I'm talking about. He's a great writing teacher. He's asking me my hero, my black character is Obi here, and my character in Where I'm Bound, Joe Duckett, they're both strong black men. And he's asking me where they come from. Well, a lot of it is a reaction against the stereotype of black men. And when I grew up, again, in Philadelphia, in this segregated situation, everything was about basically our being physically stronger than the whites. And ours beating them because of the situation. Right? So now, all of my uncles and my father, my father's a police inspector, right? But it was obviously, all of them were what was called, which people don't know these days, were what called all CIAA. They went to black colleges in the South, and they were all colored intercollegiate athletics. That means they were black All-Americans. And you can transpose that today, they'd be All-Americans. Huh? That's who they were. Well, I was raised around folk like that and strong black people in my church. Was one of the first black captains in the Tuskegee Airmen, shot down over the Mediterranean. He is a squadron leader there. And I never knew the stereotypical black, the stereotypical view of the cowardly, this cowardly, I never knew that person. And certainly never grew up with any of them. Right? So that probably propels it. Now, he's talking about another problem, incidentally. When you're writing, and so those of you who are writers, you can make somebody too heroic. You can make them too heroic. So, as you're writing, you have to do something. You have to give them some flaws. You have to do something to them. You have to have them do something. They have to cry sometime. They have to get drunk sometime. They have to do something bad, because otherwise they're totally unreal. And I think, unfortunately, I do tend to err on the other side, right? Right? But He's asking another question. I'm basically, you know, despite in my heart, you know, I'm a Russian specialist. That's what I am. And that's what I spent 5, 6, 7, 10 years of my life doing. And the question was I influenced or am I influenced by Russian writers? Very much so. Very much so. Again, it's difficult to put your fingers on it, but I try a lot of, I was very much influenced by Sholokhov's Quietly Flows the Don in my other book, for the Civil War. And I love Tolstoy and constantly go back to him. I love Flaubert and constantly go back to him and reread him. And I read Maxim Gorky. I don't know if you've ever heard of Gorky, but Gorky was a great writer of the people. He talked about poor people. And I was deeply influenced by him and my favorite Russian writer, Isaac Babel, B-A-B-E-L, who, you know, I just read and reread all the time. Babel was a Jewish writer who didn't act Jewish. He rode with the Cossacks in the Russian Revolutionary War, Civil War, and he was just a tremendous, and if you get an opportunity, read Babel, read it. And I mean, you can, his very first sentence, I think, in one of the short stories is the sun came up, you know, like a rolling red ball. And it's, you know, it's a war thing, a rolling red ball. You can see it like that. And his dialogue is incredible when he works with his dialogue. And he was killed by Stalin back in 1941. You know, along with a lot of other people. Right? Great, great writer. Yes?
Part of what I found interesting was to try to put myself in a situation and think, if I was a mother there, what would I do with my kids to get through this? If I was a young girl there, what would I do to get through and be healthy? If I was a young man, what would I do? As you wrote it, were you thinking of some of the social programming or things that we could do differently make those outcomes better?
Well, really, as a matter of fact, no.
Okay.
No, because one of the problems, again, a problem with writing fiction as opposed to, say, writing nonfiction, is you can't let social programs come into your head at all. You have to toss aside every bit of sense of prejudice on your part, actually, right, or a sense of solutions. Every character has to come through full and whole and has to speak as a character does in life. And the second they start preaching, then they lose reality. Right? And the reader turns him or herself off. So you can't do that. So I wasn't thinking about that when I want to do something like that. Then I do other things. Well, yes.
I read an interview with you in the Times Union, and you said that writing fiction, you had never realized how difficult it was just to get somebody into a room.
That's right.
And I just wondered what you meant by that.
Oh, in the interview with the Times Union, the question was, I made the comment that I had never realized how difficult it is to get somebody into a room. Well, the problem is, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that it's difficult. I can say, I walked through the door and went out that door. Okay? It's like that, boom. But if I want to describe it, you know, and I want you to get involved in it, I've got to think about the feet moving and where your hand is going to be. And then I've got to do, as I'm thinking about it, I've got to draw a picture for you. And as I'm doing that, I have to be very, very much aware of one other thing, one-step-itis. In other words, he lifted his right hand, put it back down again, took one step, then another step, then another step, then another. Hey, fine, guess what? He got to the door, he looked at the door, he turned his head this way, turned his head this way. You have to find a balance between that, which is really heavily descriptive, and actually, you know, just making it simple. But one step by this is the problem. So you see how it, well now, I'll play one piece of my guitar just for fun. Now I'm talked out. Right. This is my love. And realistically.
Okay.